And it's time now to move to the Nation and World page. Our first article is on Congress, headlined Foreign Aid Bill Advances. The GOP Speaker and Democrats form a rare alliance to push funding for wars, by Stephen Groves, Lisa Mascaro, and Kevin Fraking of the Associated Press. Dateline, Washington. With rare bipartisan momentum, the House pushed ahead Friday on a foreign aid package of $95 billion for Ukraine, Israel, Taiwan, and humanitarian support as a robust coalition of lawmakers helped it clear a procedural hurdle to reach final votes this weekend. Friday's vote was a seldom-seen outcome in the typically hyper-partisan House, with Democrats helping Republican Speaker Mike Johnson's plan advance overwhelmingly 316-94. Final House approval could come this weekend when the package would be sent to the Senate. It was a victory for the strategy Johnson set in motion this week after he agonized for 2 months over the legislation. Still, Johnson, Republican of Louisiana, had to spend the prior 24 hours making the rounds on conservative media working to salvage support for the wartime funding, particularly for Ukraine. Ukrainians desperately need lethal aid right now. We cannot allow Vladimir Putin to roll through another country and take it, Johnson told the conservative host of the Mark Levin show about the Russian president's invasion of Ukraine. These are very serious matters with global implications. Johnson said after the vote that while it wasn't perfect legislation, it was the best possible product Republicans can get given their thin majority in one chamber of Congress. In an extremely rare step, the members of the House Rules Committee joined forces late Thursday in a near-midnight vote, the four Democrats giving their support on a procedural step to push past the Republican majority's three hardline holdouts to send the package to the House floor for debate on a 9-3 vote. Democratic leader Representative Hakeem Jeffries of New York said he spoke with Johnson on Thursday night to ensure the bill would clear the Rules Committee. Johnson will need to rely on Democrats again Saturday to turn back amendments Republicans offered that could kill the package. One from hardliner Representative Marjorie Taylor Greene, Republican of Georgia, would reduce spending for Ukraine to zero. Passing each bill in votes expected Saturday will require Johnson to form complicated bipartisan coalitions on each, with Democrats, for example, ensuring Ukraine aid is approved, but some left-leaning progressives refusing to back military aid for Israel over the destruction of Gaza. The components would then be stitched back together into a single package sent to the Senate, where hardliners there also plan procedural moves to stall final approval. And that article from page A10 of the Nation and World section out of Washington was Foreign Aid Bill Advances. The GOP Speaker and Democrats form a rare alliance to push funding for wars, by Stephen Groves, Lisa Mascaro, and Kevin Fraking of the Associated Press. Jenny?
Thank you, Steve. And our next Nation and World article on page A10. From the Middle East, Israel, Iran downplay attack. Tehran says its air defense batteries shot down flying objects, and it's by Joseph Fetterman and John Gambrell of the Associated Press. Dateline, Jerusalem. Israel and Iran on Friday both played down an apparent Israeli airstrike near a major airbase and nuclear site in central Iran, signaling the two bitter enemies are ready to prevent their latest eruption of violence from escalating into a full-blown regional war. Israel has long considered Iran to be its greatest enemy, citing the Islamic Republic's calls for Israel's destruction, its controversial nuclear program, and its support for hostile proxies across the Middle East. These tensions have risen since Hamas and Islamic Jihad, Iranian-backed Palestinian militant groups, attacked Israel on October 7th, sparking a devastating Israeli offensive in Gaza that has continued for more than 6 months. Hezbollah, an Iranian-backed proxy in Lebanon, immediately began striking Israeli targets, opening up tit-for-tat fighting along a second front, while Iranian-backed militias in Iraq, Syria, and Yemen have also fired missiles and drones at Israel throughout the war. While Israel and Iran have waged a shadow war for years, mostly in neighboring Syria, they largely avoided direct confrontations. That changed after an April 1st airstrike killed two Iranian generals at an Iranian diplomatic compound in the Syrian capital, Damascus. Iran blamed Israel for the strike and vowed revenge. Iran responded with its first ever direct attack on Israel, launching more than 300 missiles and attack drones last weekend. Israel, working with a U.S.-led international coalition, said it intercepted 99% of the incoming fire, though a handful of missiles managed to land, causing minor damage to an Israeli military base and wounding a young girl. In Friday's attack, Iranian state television said air defense batteries fired in several provinces over reports of drones in the air. Iranian Army Commander General Abdolrahim Mousavi said crews targeted several flying objects. The explosion this morning in the sky of Isfahan was related to the shooting of air defense systems at a suspicious object that did not cause any damage, Mousavi said. Authorities said air defenses fired at the airbase near Isfahan, which long has been home to Iran's fleet of American-made F-14 Tomcats, were purchased before the 1979 Islamic Revolution. And again, that article on the Nation and World page A10, from the Middle East, Israel and Iran downplay attack. Tehran says its air defense batteries shot down flying objects, and it was by Joseph Fetterman and John Gambrell of the Associated Press. Steve?
Thank you, Jenny. Continuing with the Nation and World section, our next item is U.S. imposes sanctions over West Bank clashes to entities accused of raising money for violent Israeli settlers by the Associated Press, Dateline Washington. The Biden administration imposed sanctions Friday on two entities accused of fundraising for extremist Israeli settlers already sanctioned, as well as the founder of an organization whose members regularly assault Palestinians. The Treasury Department announcement came as the West Bank has seen some of its worst violence perpetrated by extremist settlers against Palestinians since the war in Gaza began in October. Included in the Friday sanctions are two entities, Mount Hebron Fund and Shalom Asrayach, accused of raising funds for sanctioned settlers Yinan Levi and David Chai Hasdai. Both men previously were sanctioned for attacking Palestinians in the West Bank. The penalties aim to block them from using the U.S. financial system and bar U.S. citizens from dealing with them. The fundraising campaigns of Mount Hebron Fund for Levi and by Shalom Asrayach for Hasdai generated the equivalent of $140,000 and $31,000, respectively, according to the U.S. Treasury. Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu's far-right government reacted angrily to previous sanctions imposed against West Bank settlers. And that article from page A10 was U.S. imposes sanctions over West Bank clashes to entities accused of raising money for violent Israeli settlers, from the Associated Press. Jenny?
Thank you, Steve. And our next Nation and World article on page A10. Revised Title IX rules protect some students. Biden administration avoids addressing transgender athletes. It's from the Associated Press. The rights of LGBTQ plus students will be protected by federal law, and victims of campus sexual assault will gain new safeguards under rules finalized Friday by the Biden administration. The new provisions are part of a revised Title IX regulation issued by the Education Department, fulfilling a campaign pledge by President Joe Biden. He had promised to dismantle rules created by former Education Secretary Betsy DeVos, who added new protections for students accused of sexual misconduct. Notably absent from Biden's policy, however, is any mention of transgender athletes. The administration originally planned to include a new policy forbidding schools from enacting outright bans on transgender athletes, but that provision was put on hold. The delay is widely seen as a political maneuver during an election year in which Republicans have rallied around bans on transgender athletes in girls' sports. Instead, Biden is officially undoing sexual assault rules put in place by his predecessor and current election year opponent, former President Donald Trump. The final policy drew praise from victims' advocates. And again, that Nation and World article on page 810, revised Title IX rules protect some students. Biden administration avoids addressing transgender athletes. And it was from the Associated Press. Steve?
Thank you, Jenny. Our next Nation and World article comes from the e-edition section of the April 20th Richmond Times-Dispatch and is titled Public Health, Measles Cases Up Sharply. Here's what's driving the increase in the U.S. and why it's a big deal, by Devi Shastri and Mike Staub of the Associated Press. Measles outbreaks in the U.S. and abroad are raising health experts' concern about the preventable, once common childhood virus. One of the world's most contagious diseases, measles can lead to potentially serious complications. The best defense, according to experts, get vaccinated. Here's what to know about the year so far in measles. How many measles cases has the U.S. seen this year? Nationwide, measles cases already are nearly double the total for all of last year. The U.S. Centers of Disease Control and Prevention documented 113 cases as of April 5th. There have been 7 outbreaks, and most of U.S. cases, 73%, are linked to those flare-ups. Still, the count is lower than some recent years. 2014 saw 667 cases, and 2019 had 1,274. Why is this a big deal? The 2019 measles epidemic was the worst in almost 3 decades and threatened the United States' status as a country that has eliminated measles by stopping the continual spread of the measles virus. The CDC released a report on recent measles case trends, noting that cases in the first 3 months of this year were 17 times higher than the average number seen in the first 3 months of the previous 3 years. While health officials seem to be doing a good job detecting and responding to outbreaks, the rapid increase in the number of reported measles cases during the first quarter of 2024 represents a renewed threat to elimination, the report's authors said. Where is measles coming from? The disease is still common in many parts of the world, and measles reaches the U.S. through unvaccinated travelers. According to the CDC report, most of the recent importations involved unvaccinated Americans who got infected in the Middle East and Africa and brought measles back to the U.S. Where were this year's U.S. measles outbreaks? Health officials confirmed measles cases in 17 states so far this year, including New York City, Philadelphia, and Chicago. More than half of this year's cases come from the Chicago outbreak, where 61 people have contracted the virus as of April 11th, largely among people who lived in a migrant shelter. How does measles spread? Measles is highly contagious. It spreads when people who have it breathe, cough, or sneeze, and through contaminated surfaces. It can also linger in the air for 2 hours. Up to 9 out of 10 people who are susceptible will get the virus if exposed, according to the CDC. Measles used to be common among kids. How bad was it? Before a vaccine became available in 1963, there were some 3 million to 4 million cases per year, which meant nearly all American kids had it sometime during childhood, according to the CDC. Most recovered. But measles can be much more than an uncomfortable rash, said Susan Hassig, an infectious disease researcher at Tulane University. I think that people need to remember that this is a preventable disease, Hassig said. It is a potentially dangerous disease for their children. In the decade before the vaccine was available, 48,000 people were hospitalized per year. About 1,000 people developed dangerous brain inflammation from measles each year, and 400 to 500 died, according to the CDC. Is the measles vaccine safe? Where do vaccination rates stand? The measles, mumps, and rubella, or MMR vaccine, is safe and effective. It is a routine and recommended childhood vaccine that is split into 2 doses. Research shows it takes a very high vaccination rate to prevent measles from spreading. 95% of the population should have immunity against the virus. During the COVID-19 pandemic, national vaccination rates for kindergartners fell to 93% and remain there. Many pockets of the country have far lower rates than that. The drop is driven in part by record numbers of children getting waivers. And that Nation and World article was from the e-edition section of today's Richmond Times-Dispatch and was Public Health, Measles Cases Up Sharply. Here's what's driving the increase in the U.S. and why it's a big deal, by Devi Shastra and Mike Staub of the Associated Press. Ginny?
Thank you, Steve. And our next article is from page A13. Long-Lost Star Trek Model is Back Home, by Jamie Stingel of the Associated Press, Dateline, Dallas. The first model of the USS Enterprise, used in the opening credits of the original Star Trek television series, has boldly gone back home, returning to creator Gene Roddenberry's son decades after it went missing. The model's disappearance, sometime in the 1970s, had become the subject of lore, so it caused a stir when it popped up on eBay last fall. The sellers quickly took it down and then contacted Dallas-based Heritage Auctions to authenticate it. Last weekend, the auction house facilitated the model's return. Eugene Rod Roddenberry, CEO of Roddenberry Entertainment, said he's thrilled to have the model that had graced the desk of his father, who died in 1991 at the age of 70. "This is not going home to adorn my shelves," Roddenberry said. "This is going to get restored, and we're working on ways to get it out so the public can see it, and my hope is that it will land in a museum somewhere." Heritage's executive vice president, Joe Maddalena, said the auction house was contacted by people who said they discovered it in a storage unit, and when it was brought into their Beverly Hills office, he and a colleague instantly knew that it was the real thing. They reached out to Roddenberry, who said he appreciates that everyone involved agreed returning the model was the right thing to do. He wouldn't go into details on the agreement reached, but said, "I felt it important to reward that and show appreciation for that." Maddalena said the model vanished in the 1970s after Gene Roddenberry loaned it to makers of Star Trek: The Motion Picture, which was released in 1979. "No one knew what happened to it," Rod Roddenberry said. The 3-foot model of the USS Enterprise was used in the show's original pilot episode, as well as the opening credits of the resulting TV series, and was the prototype for the 11-foot version featured in the series episodes. The larger model is on display at the Smithsonian's National Air and Space Museum. The original Star Trek television series, which aired in the late 1960s, kicked off an ever-expanding multiverse of cultural phenomena, with TV and movie spinoffs and conventions where a fan base of zealous and devoted Trekkies can't get enough of memorabilia. This USS Enterprise model would easily sell for more than $1 million at auction, but really, it's priceless, Maddalena said. "It could sell for any amount, and I wouldn't be surprised because of what it is," he said. "It is truly a cultural icon." Roddenberry, who was just a young boy when the model went missing, said he has spotty memories of it, almost a deja vu. He said it wasn't something he thought much about until people began contacting him after it appeared on eBay. "I don't think I really fully comprehended at first that this was the first Enterprise ever created," he said. He said he has no idea if there was something nefarious behind the disappearance all those decades ago, or if it was just mistakenly lost, but it would be interesting to find out more about what happened. "This piece is incredibly important, and it has its own story, and this would be a great piece of the story," Roddenberry said. Thankfully, he said, the discovery has cleared up one rumor that it was destroyed because, as a young boy, he'd thrown it into a pool. "Finally, I'm vindicated after all these years," he said with a laugh. And again, that article on was long-lost Star Trek model is back home, and it was by Jamie Stingle of the Associated Press. Steve?
Thank you, Jenny. Our next Nation and World article also is from page A13 and is headlined, American Idol alumna Mandissa dies at age 47, from the Associated Press, Dateline, Nashville, Tennessee. Mandissa, a contemporary Christian singer who appeared on American Idol and won a Grammy for her 2013 album Overcomer, has died. She was 47. A representative for the singer told the Associated Press that the singer was found dead in her home in Nashville, Tennessee on Thursday. The representative said the cause of Mandissa's death was not yet known. At this time, we do not know the cause of death or any further details, the representative said in a statement. We ask for your prayers for her family and close-knit circle of friends during this incredibly difficult time. Mandissa, whose full name was Mandissa Lynn Hundley, was born near Sacramento, California, and grew up singing in church. She gained stardom after finishing ninth on American Idol in 2006. As she left, host Ryan Seacrest told the singer that she was a great spirit on the show. Mandissa moved on, releasing her debut album in 2007 called True Beauty, which received a Grammy nomination that year for Best Pop and Contemporary Gospel Album. She went on to release five more albums, including a Christmas album. In 2014, she won a Grammy for Best Contemporary Christian Music Album for Overcomer, her fifth album. Mandissa spoke openly about her struggles with depression, releasing a memoir entitled Out of the Dark, My Journey Through the Shadows to Find God's Joy in 2022 that detailed her experiences with severe depression, weight-related challenges, the coronavirus pandemic, and her faith. Even in our darkest and lowest moments, God is in the trenches with us. He's always at work on our behalf, loving on us and carrying us up out of the dark, Mandissa wrote in an Instagram post celebrating her memoir. He never fails. I'm forever thankful that he keeps hope alive. On Friday, the Christian radio network K-Love paid tribute to the singer on social media. David Pierce, the station's chief media officer, praised Mandissa. Her kindness was epic, her smile electric, her voice massive, but it was no match for the size of her heart, Pierce said in a statement. Mandissa struggled, and she was vulnerable enough to share that with us, which helped us talk about our own struggles. Mandissa's struggles are over. She is with God, who she sang about. While we are saddened, Mandissa is home. We're praying for Mandissa's family and friends and ask you to join us. And that article from page A13 was American Idol alumna Mandissa dies at age 47 from the Associated Press. Jenny?
Thank you, Steve. And our next article is from the business page A8. Starbucks Cups to be Greener. And it's by Deanne Durbin of the Associated Press. Booming sales of cold drinks at Starbucks have created a problem. Growing amounts of plastic waste from the single-use cups that frappuccinos, refreshers, cold brews, and other iced drinks are served in. The coffee giant said Thursday it plans to alleviate some of that waste with new disposable cups that contain up to 20% less plastic. The cups are set to be rolled out to stores in the United States and Canada starting this month. Amelia Landers, Starbucks Vice President of Product Innovation, said the Seattle-based company spent the last 4 years developing the new containers. Engineers tested thousands of iterations to see how much plastic they could remove while still making the cup feel sturdy. We feel like it's industry-leading, Lander said. It's the best expression of a cold plastic cup. Starbucks says frappuccinos and other cold drinks now account for 75% of its U.S. beverage sales, up from 37% in 2013. The company estimates the new cups will keep more than 13.5 million pounds of plastic out of the landfills each year. Producing the tumblers also requires less water and creates fewer carbon emissions, a leading cause of climate change, it said. Starbucks made other changes as part of the redesign. The new cold cups feature raised dots near the bottom, so baristas, including those with impaired vision, can quickly feel with the swipe of the thumb which size cup they're holding. And the 12-ounce cup, that's the tall size in Starbucks lingo, is shorter and wider to accommodate the same size lid as larger cups. Lander said the new cups are part of a sustained sustainability push at Starbucks. The company adopted strawless lids in 2019. Last year, it said it would accept customer-provided cups for drive-through and mobile orders in the U.S. and Canada. The company plans to roll out a reusable cup program at thousands of stores in Europe, the Middle East, and Africa by next year. Starbucks also has tested U.S. reusable cup programs in California, Arizona, and Colorado. Longer term, Starbucks has said it wants all of its packaging to be reusable, recyclable, or compostable by 2030. The reduced plastic cup making its debut is a small step toward the goal. Even though the cup is recyclable, it still was designed for one-time use, Lander said. The company will continue to explore ways to make single-use cups more sustainable, she said. And again, that article from the business page, A8, Starbucks Cups to be Greener. And it was by Deanne Durbin of the Associated Press.